Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is just beginning to wonder how much a cab from Bournemouth to Croydon for Eddie Howe may cost. I'm Kevin Day and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, currently the UK's most vigorous fan of VAR.
Indeed I am. And what a great invention it is, Kevin. Yeah, so I was watching it yesterday and said that money that was being put into the technology, well worth every penny. But if it goes against us next week, I will, of course, reverse my opinion.
Absolutely, like any true football fan. It's Questions Day, Kieran, and some of our questions can only be described as antsy. I think antsy is the right word. Possibly reflecting the mood of the nation, I guess. But first, a couple of news stories. And, Kieran, I honestly don't know what tone of voice to adopt for this first one, but Steve Dalesbury have gone into administration.
Yes, Steve Dalesbury, and I think we need to say that this is Steve Dalesbury because I don't think it represents the views of the fans of either faction involved with the club or involved with the town, has gone into formal administration, appointing Stephen Wiseglass as the administrator. Now, Stephen Wiseglass was the individual who, about a year ago, was responsible for Bury's creditors voluntary arrangement, which is sort of a scenario where a company agrees to pay off its creditors a certain amount over a certain period of time. Mm. The problem with this is that Steve Dalesbury didn't pay a penny to anybody, so the creditors' voluntary arrangement collapsed. And the benefit of a CVA is it sort of puts you into a protective bubble. It reduces the opportunity for somebody to wind up a company. But that lapsed when they failed to make any payments. So there was potential winding up orders arising. And then on Friday, I think to everybody's surprise, the club has gone into administration. Now, the purpose of administration, again, it gives protection from unsecured creditors winding up a business.
Yeah.
Steve Dale knows the insolvency system. He plays the system like a piano. So the merits of this, we will have to wait and see. If anybody Googles Stephen Wiseglass, who is now the administrator, he's had a couple of issues himself to have to deal with in terms of his governing body, who have twice censured him. And as you know, it's like, Kevin, you know, off air, we have discussions about comedians and some of the things that they get up to, which don't reflect well on the industry. And I've explained to you, you know, some of the accounting things, but you don't dip in your own, do you? You know, it's sort of the omerta of whatever profession you happen to operate in. So for an accountant to be censured twice by their own organization, I think is indicative of perhaps not being the world's greatest at their particular element of the profession. And now he is the administrator. Now, the accusations which are being made, which of course are unfounded and there is no evidence, is that he's effectively doing the bidding of Steve Dale. I think the main thing to take from this is that Steve Dale will lose control over Bury Football Club. And that has upsides and downsides. I think the downside is that we'll no longer be able to see his random thoughts on the club website when he decides to put out statements. But I'm going to hope that Stephen Wiseglass does whatever is best for the assets of the club. In theory, he could now try to sell the assets of the club to raise money, and this could preserve Gig Lane. But how it's going to be paid for, how much it's going to be paid for, and what's going to happen to the mortgage over the ground. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, two things there, Kieran. For any worried comedians listening to this now, I should point out that it's strictly no names. I might occasionally tell Kieran some stories, but, you know, I don't throw the real name. I'm doing that pulling the shirt away from the neck emoji thing. the second thing, Kieran. I don't feel Kieran.
Only the Baroness calls me that.
Really, does she?
But we are practically married these days, Kevin, so we're not
yeah,
that
fair,
far away.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah, I'm desperate trying to think of some Kiri Takanawa puns, but I can't. Much as I wish no good on Steve Dale, are there jobs that are now put under threat by this at Bury? Was he still employing people, or was Bury FC still a kind of notional business rather than an actual one?
As far as I'm aware, when it ceased to be a member of the EFL, all of the staff lost their jobs. I mean, we do have these sort of tragic but also romantic stories of the groundsman still going
yes,
in to
course,
tend the pitch because of his love and affection yeah. for the club. And that is distressing and wonderful at the same time. I can't see the club would be employing people because it wasn't paying the wages when it was in the EFL very often. So I can't see how it would be paying the wages now.
Yeah, I just had this image of some ultra-loyal Alan Partridge-type secretary still administering to his every will, and I didn't want to see him or her laid off, basically. His version of Smithers. I didn't want to see him get sacked. as we predicted, Kieran, some fans will be allowed into games when lockdown ends, with as many as 4,000 being let back into grounds in Tier 1, although there is one teensy problem with that, Kieran, isn't there?
Just, yeah, one teensy problem, as you say, Kevin. Tier 1 applies to the Isle of Wight, the Isle of Scilly and Cornwall, and none of which are gracing the Premier League at present, none of which are gracing the EFL at present. So when is 4,000 not 4,000? It's in 2020. So I do think it was a little bit disingenuous of the government to say we're going to allow people in. I guess what it could be is a carrot to yeah. say to people, you know, let's really apply ourselves to lockdown, and it could be that some parts of the country might be dropped down into Tier 1, and if that is the case, it will allow an increase in the number of fans attending. We've also seen some managers complain when their clubs are in Tier 3. I know that Bielsa at Leeds... and he's said that it gives those clubs that are in Tier 2 a bit of an advantage. And I think he does have a point. It gives them, I suspect, a very tiny advantage. If you've got 2,000 people dotted around a 30 or 40,000 capacity stadium, they're not going to be making a huge amount of noise. And half the time they're moaning and abusing the players, if they're anything like my experience of going to matches. So, yes, it's not right in an ideal world, but we're not operating in an ideal world. And those clubs that are in Tier 2, I think what they're trying to do is to demonstrate to the government, look, here we are willing to put on matches. We're not going to be making very much money out of this, but if we can show that there's no impact on infection rates in those localities, then perhaps the government might say, okay, next Tier 2 will be allowed 5,000 or 10,000. So it is a case of using what the present rules as a means of persuading the government to increase attendances everywhere. Now, I was talking to a couple of clubs during the week, and I said, yeah, come on, you know, how long have you known about this? And they said, we were absolutely knocked out. You know, nobody had any idea when the government made the announcement on Monday, completely unexpected.
Well, yeah, that the complete unexpectedness is not unexpected either, is it, unfortunately? Because there were a lot of rumours washing around football that the FA Cup third round might be the target date. The tier thing, I mean, Bielsa, I understand what he's saying, but it's a little bit like VAR. It upsets us when it suits us. And if Leeds were in Tier 2, he wouldn't have said a word, basically. And I suspect that when this meaningful review comes on the 16th of December, meaningful, I'm told by politician friends, means that the Prime Minister probably will reduce a lot of areas from tier three to tier two, and everyone will go, whoa, he's lovely, he's a living saint. It wasn't just disingenuous, Kieran. This idea that 4,000 fans could be allowed back in was just either deliberately misleading or showed a willful lack of information about football, because somebody must have known that the three areas you mentioned, Cornwall, the Scilly Isles and the Isle of Wight, I believe don't have a stadium between them that holds as many as 4,000 people. So that was if that was meant to be a carrot, that was a meaningless carrot. Steve Parrish writing in the Sunday Times yesterday, I don't know when he wrote in it, but it was in yesterday, Sunday Times. He reckons having 2,000 in to Sellers Park would just about break even on matchday finances. Would you agree with that?
Yes, yes. Again, I've been sort of doing some sums, having a bit of spreadsheet heaven.
Of course.
Crunching the numbers, as you can imagine, especially as I'm still in self-quarantine for 14 days. So it's day 11 and I am crawling the walls at present. I reckon depending upon the club, I think if you're a League One or League Two club, you're probably breaking even on probably about 1,000 to 1,100 Championship clubs, Premier League clubs, perhaps 1,400 to 1,500. So they will be making a wee bit of a contribution, which has got to be anything that is generating a positive cash return has to be welcomed. And let's just hope this is the first step of many towards the return of crowds to matches, not just at football, but at all sport, of all forms of entertainment. I've got friends who are publicans. You've got friends who run theatres. You know, everybody that's working in the service sector is taking a hammering. I live pretty close to Gatwick, being in Sussex, and the impact that it's having on the surrounding area has been appalling.
Yeah, of course. Can I just check that you are self-isolating? It's not another restraining order, is it?
No, the tag's no longer applied.
Okay. So questions, Kieran, and as I say, a slightly antsy tone to some of them. I think you'll be able to spot them when they appear. Steve Dale may be interested in this first one. Tim in Bangkok. I'm leaving a brief but anxious pause there as Kieran digests the word Bangkok. Tim in Bangkok asks, again, it's one of those simple questions that I probably should have asked you a year ago. But Tim says, when you refer to the administrators and their fees, are you talking about an individual or a team? Because when you quote £600 an hour, that's obviously a lot for a single administrator, but if it's covering a team of 10, that's £60 an hour, which is an emergency plumber, says Tim, although as Tim also says, the plumber wouldn't be there as long as the administrator, but you know what he means. So that's a good point. So when you say administrator, you presumably mean a law company that has nominated one person or two people or three people to take this job on.
Yeah, the way that it works, I mean, those figures are actually per person.
Oh, they are.
The figures
that
I've quoted. So if we take a look at the administration of Bolton, the average hourly rate is £280 per hour. So that varies from £150 per hour for a junior cashier, who I suspect is on close to minimum wage or not far from it, to up to £660 in the case of Wigan for a partner if they get this very strange one-third uplift, i.e. if they have a successful sale. I think their normal fees are about £495 an hour, but that gets increased by a third if the club is sold successfully. So they are eye-wateringly expensive. You know, the Wigan administrators' fees, I think they're estimated to be around about £1.3 million, and that's assuming that the sale goes through successfully. And we do appear to have hit a few bumps in the road at present, which are concerning, because Wigan are now they're at the bottom of League One. They've lost practically the whole first team squad that was saleable. So it's a combination of they've got Bosmans, freebies, academy players, and so on.
Our next question comes from Dan Embleton. This is very much, Kieran, on the ANSI list. I'm going to try and read it in a medium tone of voice. Dan Embleton says, when I watched my team Sunderland beat Oxford away on a stream with one camera and no commentary for £10, who got that money? He says, my account is through the Sunderland website, but if the game had had supporters in attendance, presumably Oxford would have received the gate receipt. So where, says Dan, is the £10 that he paid for one camera and no commentary, although they did win? So where does that money go?
Right. Well, first of all, 20% of that goes in VAT. So I think the EFL are right in talking to the government to trying to get VAT to reduce to £5 during the pandemic, given that they can't have fans, I guess. Yeah. 30% goes in fees back to the people who are arranging the broadcast. And then I've looked at the figures that have come out from Tranmere and Colchester, and they've said the home team, because that both the home team and the away team sell the iFollow passes, the home team keep all of the money from the home fans. And I think they get the first 500 of the away fans. So at Oxford, Oxford would get the money from the first 500 passes sold by Sunderland, and then Sunderland would get the excess. Now, you know, if Sunderland sell 2,000 in a club with, you know, the support like Sunderland are likely to do so, it could be that Sunderland end up with more money than Oxford itself. But that figure of 500, I've also seen comments that what they try to do is to estimate the number of away fans and say, well, if we expected 1,000 Sunderland fans to turn up, then Oxford would keep the first 1,000 and Sunderland would get the excess. So it all seems to be a little bit vague, but a lot of money is leaking out in terms of both VAT and the broadcasters' fees. So anybody who's thinking that iFollow is a solution to the non-attendance by fans themselves, unfortunately, that is not the case. I estimate that clubs will make no more than 10 to 15% right. of the money they'd normally expect to get through match day ticket sales.
Well, we're going to be hearing a little bit more about iFollow later on, because it's definitely something that's getting under fans' collars by the sound of it. We had several questions on broadcasting rights this week, but I wanted to sort of split them up a little bit rather than have one great big long chunk. And also, I particularly wanted to throw Quentin Soldan's question in at this stage, also antsy. And Quentin says, and it starts with a statement, basically, and I'm going to do this in a bloke in the pub voice, Kieran, as I think this question deserves a bloke in the pub voice. Quentin says, didn't Spurs go cap in hand to the government for several million pounds recently? And now they're signing Gareth Bale, making him the highest paid player in the Premier League. Doesn't sit right with me, says Quentin.
Okay. Yes, he is right that Spurs have applied to the Bank of England and indeed have been granted. It was more than just a few million quid, Quentin's. Quentin's name, surely that's, isn't that the name of a James Bond character? It does.
I've got a feeling. Yes, Quentin has asked us questions before, and I think we have speculated. I'm going to say yes. It does sound like a James Bond character, but a good one.
Not
everyone can be a villain in James Bond films.
Spurs got a £175 million loan from the Bank of England at 0.5% interest. Now, in theory, that is repayable in April 2021, but I suspect the government will roll that over, or the Bank of England will roll that over for at least 12 months. And the reason why I think companies have been applying from these loans, and you've got to be a business of a minimum size, and Spurs qualify on that, is that if Spurs went to their regular bank and said, we're in the middle of a pandemic, we've got no idea when we're going to start the turnstiles rolling again, will you lend us some money? We've had this conversation before. Bank managers turn around and say, I'll have a think about it. About 3 milliseconds later, they'll say, no, it's too risky.
I recognise that scenario, Kieran.
or if you do borrow, we are going to cover our risk by charging you a pretty hefty interest rate. And I've been looking at some of the deals that football clubs have been involved with, and we're talking about interest rates of 11%, which is pretty steep in present times. So for be able to go and borrow at 0.5% from the Bank of England It makes sense from a business point of view. And remember, Spurs went from an £89 million profit to a £68 million loss. And that was just with 3 months of the pandemic or 4 months of the pandemic in their most recent accounts. So they are being hit. In terms of Gareth Bale, I can understand Quentin's feelings. At the same time, clubs want to progress. You know, that we all want to see our clubs do well. So from that point of view, it was actually quite a good deal. And I don't think Gareth Bale is the highest paid player in the Premier League, because my understanding is that Spurs are paying a fairly small fraction of his wages, and the rest of it is actually being borne by his host club, Real Madrid.
Right, okay. It's quite difficult to tell with Spurs the way they structure their wage deals, isn't it? How much a player is actually earning. But if Quentin is approaching that story from a Spurs fan point of view, he's probably going to be disappointed again on Wednesday, Kieran, because we're going to be looking in some detail at what one or two of the Premier League clubs are planning to charge the 2,000 fans that come back in. And I think they're fair to say they're quite eye-watering sums. And Tottenham is certainly one of them. So you're crunching some numbers and that for us on for Wednesday, aren't you, Kieran, for Thursday?
That's right. Yep.
Okay. Joshua Selig says, when the furlough scheme ends, do you think there will be a large number of clubs going into administration? If the answer is yes, would leagues, the EFL and the National League in particular, be required to consider relaxing their rules? And if that does happen, could there be legal action from other clubs?
I think this is an intriguing one. Clubs in League One and Two, they are now they've now been offered this £50 million package from the Premier League. I think that's progressing. It's not progressing as fast as it should. Yeah. As far as the National League is concerned, we have the issue of the grant from the National Lottery Fund. And if only, Kevin, we could get a club owner to come onto the club on Wednesday and perhaps give us their point of view if they're unhappy. Yeah. And we'll see. We'll see if we rub our bottle well enough, whether a genie will come out of that particular one.
Don't remind me, I'm not looking. Perhaps you should elaborate on that comment, Kieran, basically, before, because rather than leave our lovely listeners guessing, but suffice to say, I'm really not looking forward to it already, to be perfectly honest.
I am looking forward to it. Oliver Ash, who is a club owner in the National League, has I think it's fair to say that he took us to task with when we've been dealing with this issue recently. So in the spirit of openness and transparency, we've invited him on the show. So that I think it'll be an interesting discussion to get his viewpoints. We've seen the National League board's comments, which were robust and quite defensive, and we've also, of course, spoken to people at Chester and other clubs as well who are unhappy. So we're trying to get the full range here.
Okay, Kieran, can I just point out before you answer Joshua's question, he took you to task, but it's me that's going to be interviewing him. That's my issue here with producer Guy, as I know you'll be there in case there are some numbers questions. But basically, Guy went, oh, he's had we've had this really quite angry email to Kieran. Can you sort him out? Oh yeah, great. Oh, no, I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure it'll be a full and frank discussion of issues that I didn't know you'd said, basically.
Well, I don't remember saying them either. But we'll be fun. It'll be fun.
Yeah, he'll do. But it's like one of those Morecambe and Wise sketches where Des O'Connor comes on with a postcard size number of complaints that then unfolds like a concertina into Des O'Connor. There's a reference, God rest his soul. Well, he was a lovely chap. Anyway, so Joshua's question, furlough.
I don't think the furlough is the issue, because most clubs that are playing at present are out of furlough by definition. You know, the furlough scheme is a job retention scheme. Yeah. Now, if clubs in the EFL are playing football, by definition, they are at their place of work. My concern is when the government's VAT and other tax delay legislation that expires, and then clubs have to start paying their tax bills We did see a question asked in the House of Commons by Damian Collins, who's again has been on the show. He's an MP, and the I think clubs in the EFL do owe considerable sums of money in unpaid taxes at present. So that's my major concern. In terms of will there be action taken by one club against another, that could be the case. I don't think they'd be successful because I can't see on what grounds they could claim to have been disadvantaged. Right. And we did see when Steve Gibson at Middlesbrough had his case against Derby County earlier in the week that failed. So with a bit of luck, hopefully people will see sense. Will clubs go out of business? Again, going back to Joshua's original question, it's got to be a risk. A lot will depend as to what we're coming out into in terms of getting the timing and getting the cash flows right. If more towns and cities return to tier two and tier one, and of course this will have a much greater proportionate impact on clubs in League One, League Two, and the National League, and they get the turnstiles clicking again, it could give them enough cash to see them over so that when the cash, when the tax bills come in, that they are in a position to pay them. Oliver Dowden has said that he's not going to allow any clubs to go to the wall as a result of HMRC pressure. So there is an acknowledgement from government that clubs are in a precarious position. And again, this applies to huge swathes of the economy at present. So it's a case of wait and see.
Yeah, you've just upset one Derby fan in particular. I absolutely 100% guaranteed him that Derby wouldn't be mentioned under any circumstances whatsoever. Stefan Gampst has asked a very interesting question. Stefan talks about the Norwegian broadcaster TV2, who owned the rights for the Premier League in the period 2019-2022, i.e. at the moment. TV2 has now increased the monthly fee for that service from 499 kroner to 699 kroner. That's a 40% increase, claiming rising costs for the rights. In comparison, it costs 399 Swedish krona in, well, Sweden, obviously, to watch today. I didn't quite think that one through. Stefan says, is this reasonable? And now, the exchange rate is pretty much one-to-one, so it is a fair comparison. And I did look up the Norwegian word for antsy. Google Translate couldn't help, although Maggie Mauer does mean a lot of ants. So right. It's a fair point, though. I mean, why are you paying so much more in Norway than you are in Sweden to watch pretty much the same service?
Yeah, I a bit like you, I did a bit of exchange rate translation. So it's gone from 41 quid to 59 pounds a month. Yeah, that is steep. That's almost the price of a pint in Norway. that does seem to me to be excessive when in Sweden it's only £35 a month. So what I expect we will see here is, first of all, a rise in piracy. When you price something inappropriately, then you run the risk of people looking for alternative means of gaining that goods or service. So I think it's a fairly dumb approach that's been taken by TV2. I can't understand why they agreed to pay the Premier League a 40% increase if they knew that the only way of dealing with that is to recover it from their subscribers, because clearly that's going to upset their subscribers. I think the one thing that they are banking on is that, having lived most of my life in Manchester, that Norwegian fans of both Manchester United and Liverpool are some of the most passionate, most devoted, and therefore it could be that TV2 thinks that they're a bunch of suckers and they'll just keep lapping up regardless of the prices that are being charged. My advice here is to turn around to TV2 and say we're not prepared to pay it. And if enough fans do this, and here you've got to be organised, We've got social media, we've got the opportunity to do petitions and things. If I was Norwegian fans of Manchester United and Liverpool and Arsenal and Chelsea and so on, I tried to get together as a collective and just say, right, we're cancelling our subscriptions. We're not going to do anything until you drop the price back to the original one, which at £41 a month is still pretty steep. If you're willing to pay the Premier League 40% more, then it's your problem. Don't pass your problems down to us as fans.
I once flew from Oslo Airport to Liverpool on very late on a Friday night with some spectacularly drunk Norwegian Liverpool fans, which is a story for another pod. But it was an astonishing, because it was like an invasion guard. There must have been 40-odd flights going out that night to various points of the British Isles to watch English and Scottish football. And there's a supporters club for every single club in England, basically, in Norway and in Sweden. It's their passion for English football is astonishing. I don't know as much about Scandinavia as I should, Kieran. So if any of our Scandinavian listeners are able to add more information as to why it might be so much more expensive to watch football in Norway than in Sweden, I'd be glad to hear from you. We have another broadcasting rights question, Kieran, and it's from Chris, the Norwich fan. And Chris, the Norwich fan, has asked us questions before. He's a friend of the show. Hello, Chris. Chris says, thank you for your suggestion of going to Delia's for a slap-up meal. Unfortunately, I live in New Zealand, so that's not really an option. On the other hand, Chris, you live in a COVID-free paradise run by a government of talent and integrity. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. And Kieran, if you could stop sending people to Delia's for slap-up meals, by the way. She hasn't got a restaurant. Why don't you treat yourself to a slap-up meal at Delia's? They're looking up her address and turning up on a Sunday morning. She's one of my favourite women, Delia's, so she's lovely. Here in New Zealand, says Chris, I subscribe to a streaming service called Spark Sport, which costs $25 New Zealand a month, which is about 13 quid. For this, I can watch every single Premier League game plus other sports. Unfortunately, with Norwich being relegated, if I want to watch all their games, I need to pay $270, which is 140 quid, for iFollow, plus a Sky Sports subscription because Sky games aren't on iFollow. So if every game was on iFollow, though, that would cost £5.87 a game compared to 79 cents for Premier League games. So Chris's question is, would the EFL be better to follow the Premier League model and sell games as a package instead of club by club? But it does seem ludicrous, Kieran. It's far more expensive to watch EFL games than it is to watch Premier League games.
It does seem ludicrous. I mean, I've sort of tried to do a bit of digging into the numbers. The Premier League rights in New Zealand weren't sold for a huge amount of money because, yeah, we've got to remember, New Zealand is a rugby country.
Of course, yeah.
So there's a limited amount of interest among New Zealand fans. The ones that are there, of course, very passionate, and they're no less passionate than local fans. I'm not saying that. That means that let's say that if the Premier League TV deal is worth £10 million a year in terms of what the local broadcasters prepared to pay, realistically, how much could the EFL expect to get from selling their rights? And we've seen a lot of historically a lot of EFL club owners, and I won't mention Derby County here.
Again, he's going to be so angry with me, that bloke.
say that they feel that the EFL rights, which are worth £119 million a year domestically, were vastly undersold by the previous chief executive, Sean Harvey. I've got to be honest, I don't think that assessment is necessarily correct, certainly today, because what was the biggest club in the EFL? In my view, it was Leeds United. You know, and that's why Leeds United used to be on so much, because they do have a much broader fan base, you know, dotted around the country and internationally. So the EFL has lost Leeds United. It's lost Aston Villa. It's lost Newcastle United. What would, I think this is sort of a general question, what would be the biggest match this season in the EFL between two clubs? And I pondering that, and I couldn't genuinely think of it. you know, it's not going to be Brentford versus QPR. Is it going to be perhaps Derby versus Forest?
Stop that now. No more Derby references.
Oh, no, that was a positive reference.
Yes, it is. No, yeah, that's a good question, actually. I suppose, yeah, it's a very interesting question.
So I'm not convinced that the EFL would be able to get a decent price for the rights. And therefore, I follow as an alternative. I can see it from Chris's perspective that it's frustrating. But the good thing about iFollow is at least the money is going, you know, when he subscribes, the money is going to Norwich.
Yeah.
And it's not being split between 72 clubs. So at a time when all clubs are looking for support from their own supporters, this is a way of getting money to a club on a bespoke basis. Mm.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Now, Shay Cunningham's question is a positive haiku after the three-act play I managed to turn the New Zealand question into. Shay said that he heard on a recent show, I think it was probably 3 months ago, but time is concertinaed during the pandemic. Shay heard on a recent show that auditors Ernst & Young alerted the police in Singapore to issues in their FA accounts. So in relation to the Football Association of Ireland, were auditors Deloitte obliged to bring discrepancies in their accounts to the attention of the police?
Under law, if you are aware of a criminal act, especially if it involves the likes of money laundering or bribery, you are obliged to bring it to the attention of the authorities, or terrorism. So there are specific things. If it is an internal crime, then it should be brought to the board of directors themselves, and then it's up to them as to how they are to proceed. So it is very complicated, this. For those people that are unfamiliar with what's been happening in Ireland, Ireland's chief executive, John Delaney, appeared to be living a quite successful lifestyle. He was paid a lot of money. His ex-girlfriend was given a £60,000 for being an agent for when I think Ireland played England. I don't think his wife at the time was impressed by this payment. And the ex-girlfriend said that money never actually ended up in her account. So she was, I think that's why she's the ex-girlfriend. So that was all very complicated. And the FAI, the Football Association of Ireland, it received £5 million from Sepp Blatter at FIFA. But John Delaney didn't disclose that in the accounts. In fact, nobody seemed to know what the purpose of that money was. In 2010, all very mysterious. There's a very good book called Champagne Football about John Delaney. Not as good as Who Are You? By Kevin Day. If people are looking for Christmas presents.
Thank you.
For their loved ones who like football. But it does go into quite a lot of depth in relation to what's happened at the FAI. So Deloitte, they are presently subject to a lawsuit from the FAI for lack of disclosures. They are claiming, however, that they were misled by the directors, and they are the innocent party in this. Given that Deloitte publish their annual football review, they are looking with huge amounts of egg on face at present. But I don't think they were necessarily obliged, especially as I don't think they actually found some of the nature of these payments involving Delaney. He's certainly, I think he could be making an appearance in our special Wrong'un show, though, for which we are still writing the script because it changes by the week.
Right. To underline then the answer to Shay's question, Deloitte, the auditors, they will be 100% fully aware of the circumstances in which they have to bring something to the attention of the police, won't they, as part of their professional responsibility. So they will know what things have to go to the police and what things have to go to the directors of the company that they're auditing.
That's correct, yes. So, you know, they are there on behalf of shareholders. But in terms of legal responsibilities, that tends to be money laundering, terrorism, things of that nature, rather than fraud. I mean, a lot of fraud does take place. There's a lot of strange activities taking place. We've got Manchester United at present, whose IT systems have been subject to a cyber attack. If the stories in the newspapers are to be believed, and you know, we always have to take them with this pinch of salt, Manchester United's transfer plans are included in the stuff which has been nicked by the cyber terrorists. They can't communicate, and they are subject to extortion. So, you know, it does get quite murky as to what the auditors should and shouldn't do.
Okay, Terry Austin has a question regarding fan-owned clubs. Now, I asked you this exact question recently, Kieran, in regard to Wrexham, but you got distracted by, I can't remember what it was, probably a story about your dog and a pheasant, I imagine. you didn't properly answer it, as I remember mentioning that to you at the time after the pod. But Terry's got a question, which I think is a very simple but very interesting one. If a fan-owned club is sold to someone for proper money, who is the money paid to? Do the fans split it between them? And who, this is a good secondary question, who negotiates the sale for a fan-owned club?
Right. The beneficiaries here depends upon the nature of the deal. If the fans trust sells its shares to the new owners, then in theory, the fans trust would then distribute that money amongst its members.
Right.
However, if the club itself issues the shares to the new owners, then the football club would be the beneficiary, and the investment from the issue of those shares could be used by the football club to spend on infrastructure, to spend on talent acquisition, to a new manager, and things of that nature. So it would very much depend on the deal itself. And I've forgotten the second part of the question, so could you just repeat that to me?
Yeah, this is part of the question that really interested me, actually. Who would negotiate the sale? If you're a fan-owned club, do you nominate two or three savvy financial fans to negotiate the sale of the club to you, or do you pay somebody expert to negotiate the deal? So Wrexham, for example, being taken over by the Hollywood superstars, who would be negotiating on behalf of Wrexham with the Hollywood superstars?
Well, if a club is run by a supporters trust, the members, the fans, would vote for the board of trustees, and it would be their responsibility to negotiate. Now, it could be that those members feel that they do not themselves have sufficient expertise or experience of a mergers and acquisitions deal, and therefore they might appoint advisors to negotiate on their behalf. So a lot will depend upon personal circumstances. If the bigger the club, the more likely they are to try to get a third party to help them with negotiations, effectively an agent. If it's a small club, then I think you might say, well, you know, we've got such and such a guy who does work for an investment bank, and we've got a couple of lawyers on board, and we'll use people internally. So it would vary depending upon the size of the deal.
Right, back to ANSI. Jamie Walmsley has a general question about FFP and will it be scrapped or adjusted due to COVID losses, but specifically a question about his club, Preston, who paid players fully throughout lockdown, whereas, as Preston manager Alex Neil has been saying quite publicly and quite loudly, Forest and Derby,
Forest and Derby signed big money players and deferred their wages during this pandemic. Would FFP allow that?
It will make relatively little impact for FFP because what we have seen is the EFL has relaxed the rules. Now, relaxed is not the same as abolished.
Right, okay.
So it looks as if the losses are going to be spread over two seasons and you will be given some form of an allowance for the lack of match day income. And it could also be for the adjustments to solidarity payments from the Premier League. It could be that adjustments for your sponsor deals and so on. So this does make sense because this is to stop a club in the Championship who perhaps does have a very rich owner saying, well, if they're going to abolish the FFP rules for this season, I'm going to spend £100 million on five very good players and use them as a vehicle to get promoted. So there is FFP still being used. Those clubs which have taken advantage of the furlough, I think they will be beneficiaries of this from an ultimate assessment from an FFP perspective. But this ultimately will be a decision which will be made by the owners of clubs in the EFL because you have to have a majority to make decisions. Now, the decision which has been made in respect of the Championship, I don't think they've finalised the issues yet because, to be fair to the people, the EFL, they are running around just trying to put out as many fires as quickly as they can. And as soon as one goes out, another one appears.
Yeah, would this be a club in the Championship with a wealthy owner such as Bournemouth, for example, Kieran, who you were only too happy to share a photograph with me of their CEO giving a £150,000 Rolls Royce to his young Russian girlfriend as an early Christmas present? Because it ticked a lot of your boxes, that story, Kieran, didn't it?
Well, to be fair, the young lady involved was his wife rather than girlfriend. But I think here is a case of if you're going to do it, don't flaunt it. So when this came out on Instagram, and I followed up on social media, and it does seem to have gone a wee bit viral. If the clubs in the EFL Championship are in need of financial assistance, and there is a case for saying that some do, there is a case for saying that perhaps some don't. If the chief executive of a club spends £140,000 on a brand new Bentley with the personalised number plates for his wife, As taxpayers, I think we're going to turn around and say, well, we don't think you're in need of any form of government handouts. Yeah. Because if you can afford to do that, then you can probably afford to look after your own club. And this is sort of the argument I think we've tried to put forward on the show, that when it comes to the Championship, we should be looking at clubs on a case by case basis, because we've had Gary Sweet from Luton on the show and he was absolutely superb, and we've had other people with Billy from Millwall. Those clubs are not the wealthy clubs in the division. Bournemouth are, and I'm sure ultimately it's up to people to choose how they spend money. All I can say is that going back to my personal circumstances and my girlfriend in Moscow, she was very keen on English chocolate, and I remember what happened when I brought her across a multi pack of Twirls and how she thanked me. So for a Bentley, I imagine the owner or the chief executive of Bournemouth is going to get his money back.
Yeah, it's entirely my fault for throwing that in at short notice. That question. We have three question 12s. Good Lord. How did you get those through? Never mind. We have three questions left. And I think the first one, Kieran, you, for reasons that will become self-evident, you can answer more fully in a week or two's time, because it comes from David Haziel. And David says, you often talk about clubs like Accrington and Tranmere as examples of well-run, family-oriented clubs, and rightly so, says David. My team, Plymouth Argyle, has an owner who's put in an enormous amount of his own cash to help redevelop the stadium, fund ongoing losses, and see us through the pandemic, all funded via loans converted into shares. Where do you see Argyle in terms of best-run clubs, particularly in terms of financial transparency. Well, David, you'll be pleased to know that owner, of course, is Simon Hallett. And we are due to interview him in a few days' time about his love for his hometown club. So listen out for that. And we'll explore these issues in more detail then. But just quickly, Kieran, for now, where do Argyle rate? And I'm particularly interested that David asks about the financial transparency.
Well, I think Plymouth are excellent. Yeah, we've said that they are in very much a sort of an untapped giant, you know, a club which has perhaps never achieved what it could potentially achieve, given that it has sort of a dominance geographically where it's based. Yeah, we've had some correspondence with Simon recently, and he is coming on to the show probably in a couple of weeks' time. So he's been very open with us, and we're very much looking forward to the chat. I think Plymouth are up there with the good ones.
It's actually, you know, this is not a spoiler alert. It will come up in the interview. It's actually rather a touching story because he's a local lad who made very good, and wanted to thank the city. The quote is, "I wanted to thank the city that educated me and helped me," which I think is rather lovely, and funding a football team is a very good way of doing that. Ben Wicker is a Norwich fan. I don't know if he's in New Zealand or Norwich, but Ben Wicker is a Norwich fan with a particular interest in the Max Aarons link to Barcelona. It seems, Kieran, that Barcelona are not willing to include an obligation to buy clause as part of a loan deal. And Ben wants to know, why do clubs agree loan deals with an obligation to buy rather than just arranging a permanent transfer? Can you enlighten us with your wisdom? I'm not sure if Ben's being sarcastic there. I'm an expert in sarcasm. It's very hard to pick up on his tone. But in the spirit of goodwill, in the middle of an antsy podcast, I'm going to say he's not. So can you enlighten him with your wisdom?
This all comes down to the impact that an option to buy has on the accounts. If it's a commitment to buy, what you would effectively do is say, If we have to buy the player at the end of the year, then we'd have to work out an amortization charge over potentially both the loan period and the period of the contract. Now, that could either accelerate or decelerate the costs, and therefore that would have FFP implications. When it comes to Max Aarons and Norwich, you can understand why the club are looking for a greater commitment from Barcelona than Barcelona are perhaps prepared to give, because he's a very good player. What's Norwich's aim this season? It's to get promoted. And if they get promoted, then they go into the Premier League and they get their share of that £100 million. Well, they get that £100 million from TV money. So if Barcelona are only willing to pay a small loan fee, let's say a couple of million, then and not commit to paying, say, a £30 million transfer fee at the end of the season, then if I was Norwich, I'd turn it down, because the benefits of getting promoted exceed the benefits of what they are guaranteed is £2 million. If Max Aarons goes to Barcelona and proves to be a superb player, then Barcelona are picking up a bargain at £30 million. So that's the logic behind it. It's all linked to how this would impact upon the accounts of both clubs.
Well, okay. Well, interestingly, our final question is about future transfer sell-on fees. It comes from George Self. And George, you've asked a question which, again, is one of those things that I keep thinking I need to know the answer to and assume that I do know the answer to, but I'm about to see if I'm right. George, in particular, wants to talk about his club, Ipswich Town, who have made a fair amount of money from transfer sell-on fees recently. For example, when Adam Webster signed, for reasons known only to himself, for Brighton from Bristol City. If Webster was then sold on by Brighton, would Ipswich get a cut of Bristol City's sell-on fee? So, in other words, if Palace sell a player, do the club that we got it from get sell-on fees? You know, do all transfers have sell-on fees? Is it like Terry Pratchett's turtles? Is it turtles all the way down, Kieran?
No, it's not. And the reason for this is that ultimately the sale of a player's registration is a contract between two parties. So when it came to the case of Adam Webster, this was a contract between Ipswich and Bristol City. Now, when you sign a contract, you cannot oblige a third party to do something else. So it could be that Bristol City have got a sell-on clause with Brighton in the case of Adam Webster, in which case Bristol City would give some money, but that would, there's no obligation for Brighton to give any money to Ipswich. Now, it could be that as part of the contract between Ipswich and Bristol City, that if Ipswich are entitled to 20% of the deal could be not just the fee paid by Bristol City, not just the fee that they get from the initial sale to Brighton Hove Albion, but also any further monies that they get from the sale if they have a sell-on clause themselves. So what we would have to do here is to go into the small print of the contract and see the individual obligations, but there would be no obligation on Brighton to give money here to Ipswich directly. It could be that the money goes indirectly because the definition of the sell-on fee includes the sale by the player from Brighton to whatever club it is.
So, for example, then, when Palace sold Wan-Bissaka to Man United, could we have insisted on a clause that says we want sell-on money when United sell him to City and when City sell him to Barcelona and when Barcelona sell him to Bayern Munich? Could we have said, you know, decreasing amounts all the time? But would, you know, Man United probably would have to turn around and say, well, we can't guarantee that because it would be part of the deal between us and City.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
So you cannot force under contract law a third party that is not signing the contract to any obligations.
I understand. Good. I hope that answers your question, George, and it turns out I was wrong. Now, Kieran, to finish, it's quite clear from the tone of some of the questions that we've discussed today that we're all in need of a bit of pre-Christmas cheer. I don't know what you're turning the page. You've been reading a book while we've been talking, Kieran. is that how you're multitasking these days? So, yes, we're all in need of some pre-Christmas cheer, Kieran. I think the whole country is in need of a bit of a cheer-up. So how about a potentially technically disastrous football finance quiz where you can welcome our actual faces into your actual homes for some live festive fun, possibly with a guest appearance by Ali, although I haven't asked her yet. So, yes, I think you've got some news on this, haven't you, Kieran?
Well, yes, Kevin. I mean, as we're in various forms of lockdown in tiers 2 and 3, but for our listeners in the Isle of Wight, we're jealous of you, or our listener in the Isle of Wight, I suspect. There's a limit to the number of episodes of comedy reruns we can watch on Dave in the evening. So we're going to attempt the first, and given our technological problems historically, could be our last Price of Football quiz. So the intention is it to take place on Monday the 7th of December. There's a slight caveat here. Brighton are playing Southampton on the evening of the 7th of September, and if I manage to get a ticket, if I'm one of the lucky 2,000, then I'm going to the match. But we will run it either that night or the following night in all probability. And we're going to do this via Zoom. So we'll put up a link to Zoom. And we're going to be using the Kahoot quiz platform. If you've done Kahoot quizzes before, yeah, they are quite good fun. They do all the scoring for you, and you get points based on A, getting answers correct, but B, the speed at which you put through your answers. So we'd certainly recommend that you get the Kahoot app because you're going to need two screens. So get that for your smartphones. We're going to have, I think we've got 20 or 22 questions, mainly from the world of my spreadsheets. Although I believe you're writing a couple of questions on the history of the Pawson's Arms too, Kevin, which might be beneficial to people in Norbury. There's going to be prizes for the winners, including Who Are You, Kevin's book, on why you shouldn't support 92 clubs. Yep. We'll give the Price of Football book for anybody that you know that's got an OCD personality and a love of spreadsheets, and you don't like that much. And I do still have a few of the top trump card sets available. So we'll put those together. The first prize, I think, will be all three as a package together. Football finance top trumps is it's Christmas Day. You've got your racist auntie round. You don't know what to say to her anymore. This is a way of sort of filling in those hours before she goes home, and you can ignore her for the next 12 months.
Yeah, that's one upside of the bubble system, is that the racist auntie is way down the bubble list. And also, this will be a proper quiz. We'll make it as entertaining as possible, and it will be live. And some of the questions will be based on things that we've talked about, so they may not necessarily be football finance. A working knowledge of Russian might help you with some of the answers to the questions, but hopefully it'll be a fun way to pass an hour and 15 minutes. And we'll bung some, there'll be a couple of music questions in there. For those of you not familiar with Kahoot, it is a very, very good way of doing an interactive quiz. And if you've got your partner with you or your children with you who are also interested, it's a great way of getting them to join in as well. And you'll be able to gaze in awe on our actual real faces and see, well, you've all seen Kieran. I think we've seen a lot of Kieran's bookcase in this pandemic with his book,
yes,
proudly. And I'll have to tidy up the front room and put my BAFTA nomination certificate in a very visible place. So that's taking place on the 7th or the 8th of December. We'll try and get details of that to you as quickly as possible. We're about to go over Guy's Golden Hour. So I'll just say to you, as I always say, if you have any questions for us on any aspect of football finance or indeed on how the quiz is going to work, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. We will see you on Monday. I wish we could see you, but we'll see. Oh, and actually, we will see you soon for the quiz. And I'll leave you, Kieran, to say your quick. Can we? Let's go for the quick message this week rather than
Let's just stay safe, boys and girls, and look after yourselves.
Thank you. Yes. Happy unlockdown, everybody.
Bye-bye.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.